Thanks, Bill. I have a handout, so I'll just start it and see how far it goes. I hope there's enough. As you'll see, and you get the handout, I've made a slight, just one slight change in the title. It's entitled now Temporality and Progression in Michael Frayn's Copenhagen. This is kind of neither a physicist nor a drama studies look at the play. It's a narrative theorist look at it. Most commentators on Michael Frayn's Copenhagen emphasize the link between the physics it treats, especially Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and its larger thematic concerns. John Zeman, emeritus professor of physics at Bristol University, offers a representative view. Quote, "Nobody can know what happened that evening in Copenhagen when Heisenberg returned to visit Bohr. The context and dimensions are too complex and contradictory. But these are also the context and dimensions of the great world of physics. They can no more be reconciled or resolved in the large than in the small. The play rehearses in microcosm the indeterminacy of all our lives and works. It's a fable for our times, a Greek tragedy where fate itself is shrouded in mystery and uncertainty." Now, I want to argue today that this understanding of the play is only half right, because it fails to recognize the fundamental incompatibility between the uncertainty principle and the thematic emphasis given to it in the play and Frayn's choice of dramatic form. The result of this incompatibility, however, I'm going to go on to argue, is not an incoherent play, but one that keeps the logic of its coherence in the background while the thematics of uncertainty remain in the foreground. So here I want to try to work toward bringing out this logic by examining the relation between what I call narrative progression and temporality in the play. And in order to see this relationship as clearly as possible, I'm going to initially bracket the play's thematic emphasis on uncertainty and then come back to it at the end of the talk. And I'll begin by trying to explain what I mean by the terms temporality and progression, and by saying something about what's at stake in talking about their relationship. So by temporality, I mean in part what Gerard Genet means when he talks about the relation between story time and discourse time, relations expressed by his concepts of order, duration, and frequency. And you can start to see this on the handout. In Genet's conception, temporality and narrative is a function of the relation between the actual chronological order of represented events and the representation of those events in the narrative itself. Thus, order refers to the relation between that chronological sequence and the sequence in which events are represented. In Copenhagen, we obviously have a very complex relationship between story order and discourse order. Frayn moves from the present time of the play, that unspecified point in the afterlife, back to the famous evening in September 1941, when Heisenberg went back to Copenhagen to visit Bohr. Then it moves forward to 1947, then back to the 1920s, and back and forth and so on, 45, 47, etc. Okay, frequency refers to the number of times a narrative presents the same event. In Copenhagen, several events are obviously presented multiple times, and the central event, Heisenberg's visit, is presenting, depending on how one counts, at least five times. Duration refers to the relation between the amount of time an event takes in the story and the amount of time given to it in its representation. So again, in Copenhagen, Margrethe Bohr tells us that the central event, the conversation between Bohr and Heisenberg, takes only 10 minutes. But the play, with its multiple returns to that event, obviously gives it considerably more time than that 10 minutes. Now, I said that by temporality, I mean in part what Genet conceives of it as, because Genet's model has been productively complicated by several other narrative theorists, including at least three at this conference. David Herman has pointed out that many narratives have what he calls fuzzy temporalities, that is, temporalities in which the relation between story and discourse cannot be precisely pinned down. Brian Richardson has persuasively argued that Genet's approach works much better for narratives based on a mimetic model of time than it does for a significant tradition of narratives built on non-mimetic models, in which the category of event itself is often put into question. And Brian, I believe, will be talking more about that this afternoon. Peter Rabinowitz has demonstrated another significant kind of temporal order for some narratives. Neither the order of events nor the order of the discourse, but rather the order in which a character experiences those events. Peter calls this order a path, the character order. Okay, and then the other reason why I say, I want to say adopt Jeanette's model only in part is because I want to forge this link between temporality and narrative progression. So here's the other part of the handout, this stuff on progression. By that term, I mean the synthesis of the textual and readerly dynamics of a narrative, the connection between the internal mechanisms of its forward movement through time and the audience's developing responses to that movement. There are two main mechanisms for driving a narrative forward: the introduction and complication of instabilities and of tensions. I define instabilities as unsettled or conflictual relations between, among, or within characters, and I define tensions as unsettled relations between tellers and audiences. Tensions stem from differences between or among authors, narrators, and audiences in knowledge, values, perceptions, or beliefs. Okay, so that's sort of the internal side, the textual dynamic side. And then as these internal mechanisms are working, a narrative will evoke responses in its audience of several kinds, especially cognitive, emotive, and ethical responses. I regard progression as a synthesis of textual and readerly dynamics for two main reasons. First, I believe that an audience's responses are closely tied to their temporal experience of narrative. And second, I believe that authors' constructions of textual dynamics are actually deeply influenced by their assumptions about audience dynamics. To take just a little example, think about a narrative with a surprise ending. If we want to explain the effects of that narrative and the surprise, we obviously need to pay attention to the audience's temporal experience of the narrative. And if that's right, then I think it's fair to say that not just that the audience's experience is a consequence of the way the author manages the arrangement of instabilities and tensions, but also that that arrangement is influenced by the author's awareness of the audience. So my claim here is that what's true about narratives with surprise endings is true about all narratives. So I want to link Jeanette's model of temporality, as usefully revised and complicated by David and Peter and Brian, with this concept of progression in order to call attention to the way that narrative temporality itself both influences and is influenced by the presence of the audience. In other words, I want to underline temporality as a significant dimension of the pattern of instabilities and tensions, and to consider the consequences of that dimension for audience response. Doing that yields a model of temporality with the four components listed on the handout. So again, just to review, the temporality of the story, that is the chronological sequence of events apart from the way they're represented, which that sequence may or may not be fully reconstructible. And second, the temporality of the discourse, the presentation of those events, Jeanette's concepts of order, duration, and frequency, very helpful. And third, the temporality of the character paths. And four, that of what I'll call the audience path, that is the audience's temporal experience of the three previous components and the relation of that temporal experience to the pattern of instabilities and tensions. Now, a full analysis of the temporality of Copenhagen would clearly take far more time than I have today. So what I'm going to do here is just focus on one global issue of the temporality, Frayn's decision to make the present time of the play that unspecified moment in the afterlife of the three characters, and then I'll turn to a more detailed analysis of the play's ending. And I liked what Christopher had to say about the afterlife. I'm going to take a slightly different approach. What's striking about Frayn's use of the present time of the action is that it actually works against standard dramatic principles. Stage drama typically has as its core the acting out of the introduction, complication, and resolution of instabilities. Tensions can be an important addition to that pattern. But the main technical advantage of drama, dramatic over non-dramatic narrative, is its ability to put characters in action immediately before an audience. Frayne could very easily have constructed the play so that the present time of the action, that moment in the afterlife, functions as a frame that opened and closed the action, and then constructed the main action as the characters reenacting the events of 1941, as well as those of 1920s and 1947, etc. But Frayne actually constructs the play so that such reenactments occur for any significant duration only once, in Act One, with the first presentation of the evening of September 1941. And even here, Frayne has both Margareta and Heisenberg comment on the events from their perspective in the afterlife. Now, the first effect of this apparently non-dramatic choice is to make the character, to make Heisenberg, Bohr, and Margareta character narrators. They take turns telling each other about the past. The second effect is to make the play one that's driven primarily by the tension between Frayne and the audience, much the way mystery narratives are driven by such tensions. Here, however, the issue is not who done it, but why done it. That is, why did Heisenberg return to Copenhagen? The two effects work together to underline the way Frayne's use of the temporal present actually makes his narrative depart further from the pattern of typical mystery narratives. In such mysteries, the detective, whether the narrator or not, must work through a tangle of instabilities before he or she can resolve the tension of whodunit. In Copenhagen, however, tension is much more important than instability. Heisenberg and the Bohrs stay primarily focused on working out the why done it in the present time and in the afterlife as they tell their stories about the past. Now, I hasten to add that this doesn't mean there are no significant instabilities, and I list three main ones. First, although Bohr and Heisenberg had a significant father-son relationship, one that for Bohr was a replacement for the one he had with his son Christian, who drowned in a boating accident, that relationship suffered an irreparable breach in 1941, a breach not yet healed in the present time of the action. While Greta, for her part, has always been suspicious of Heisenberg, and she retains the suspicion as the play begins and moves forward. And third, each man has had a conflicted relationship with what he did in the war, Heisenberg in working on atomic energy for the Third Reich, and Bohr in consulting with the Americans at Los Alamos. Now, although these instabilities among the characters occasionally flare up in the present action and affect their efforts to solve the why done it, those instabilities never dominate the action. As a result, the audience recognizes that once the tension is resolved, the instabilities can be resolved as well. Now, by constructing the narrative as tension-driven, Frayne makes the temporal paths of the characters overlap with the path of the authorial audience during the present time of the play. Of course, the characters start their paths earlier than the audience, and they bring more knowledge to their progress. But in the forward movement of the play itself, the characters never get substantially ahead or substantially behind the audience in moving toward the resolution of the tension. Think about other mysteries where the detective does get way ahead, and we only discover that later. This is different here. Most important, the resolution occurs simultaneously for the characters and for the audience. The presence of instabilities, to be sure, introduces an important qualification. Their presence allows Frayne to inject some more typical drama into the play as they affect the way the characters go about working on the mystery, and as the instabilities show that the stakes of the resolution go beyond the cognitive answer to the mystery. In other words, the function of the instabilities, I think, in my terms, is to make Heisenberg and the Bohrs not just narrators, but also characters. And the instabilities lead the audience to desire the resolution of the tension, not only for the sake of the audience's own state of knowledge, but also for the sake of the characters. Now, if this is right, then I think all these matters show that the textual dynamics and the readerly dynamics build a strong momentum toward a positive resolution of the main tension. That is, a momentum toward a plausible explanation of why Heisenberg went to Copenhagen in 1941 and why the visit was so important. Furthermore, Frayn gives strong signals at the end of Act One that the efforts of the characters will pay off. Not only do they express their faith that, in Board's words, quote, "this time we shall get it right, this time we shall understand," Frayn also has them remind us that Bohr and Heisenberg have a pretty good track record. Again, Bohr articulates the point. After all, the workings of the atom were difficult to explain. We made many attempts. Each time we tried, they became more obscure. We got there in the end, however. So, another draft. We're set up for Act Two. Okay, so if this is at all sensible, then the move of bracketing the thematic emphasis on uncertainty enables us to see that the temporal progression of the play is actually invested in reducing uncertainty. To put this point another way, if Copenhagen ended without the characters proposing an answer to the why done it question and instead admitting defeat before it, the play would be, I think, an extremely frustrating experience for the audience. Now, this conclusion obviously needs to be complicated once I take the thematics of uncertainty out of the brackets. But before I do that, I want to look at the resolution of the tension at the end. And that consists both of Frayn's answer to the why done it question and a denouement, including a fuller account of Bohr's escape from Denmark and Heisenberg's long speech about his encounter with the SS man on his trip across Germany at the end of the war. Now, the details of Frayn's answer to the why done it question are especially notable for the way in which they make use of order, duration, and frequency. The germ of the answer comes in the character's discussion of Heisenberg's response in 1945 to learning the news about Hiroshima. Under Bohr's questioning, Heisenberg reveals that when he explained to everyone at Farm Hall how the bomb worked, he seriously overestimated the amount of uranium-235 it needed. He said 1,000 kilograms when it required only 50. This revelation sets up a series of local tensions which will eventually lead back to the global tension and its resolution. The first local tension is why Heisenberg was so far off, which gets quickly resolved in the answer he hadn't previously done the calculation. The next tension is why he didn't do that calculation, but its resolution takes longer, as Heisenberg initially claims not to know the answer, and Bohr claims that Heisenberg always did mathematical calculations before he did anything else presented with any problem. So these details, I think, signal to the audience that this tension's key to the global tension. If we can answer this, we'll be closer to knowing why Heisenberg went to Copenhagen. Now, Bohr's insistence that Heisenberg should have done the calculation leads Heisenberg to turn the question around on Bohr. Why didn't you do that calculation? When Margareta spells out what Bohr regards as the obvious answer, namely that Bohr wasn't trying to build the bomb, Heisenberg says, "I imagine it was the same with me, because I wasn't trying to build the bomb." Now, as Heisenberg's "I imagine" indicates, this answer is initially only a hypothesis, not a resolution, but does provide the pivot upon which the play returns one last time to Heisenberg's visit to Copenhagen in 1941, their last thought experiment to test that hypothesis. Now here, the return is partially reenacted, but the play gives more emphasis to the present time comments of the characters, comments that emphasize the limits of Heisenberg's self-perception, his inability to act and to observe himself acting. Bohr puts it this way: "I look at him looking at me anxiously, pleadingly, urging me back to the old days, and I see what he sees. And yes, now it comes, there's someone missing from the room. He sees me, he sees Margareta, he doesn't see himself." Well, this emphasis is on the service and application of the uncertainty principle to the scene. And here you see that the uncertainty principle insists on escaping the brackets that I'm trying to put it in. The link between it and Heisenberg's "I wasn't trying to build a bomb" also suggests it is as much a reference to psychology. What Heisenberg can't see is his unconscious motive for coming to Copenhagen. All this becomes clearer in the thought experiment that follows this last reenactment. Bohr suggests that they imagine what happens if he doesn't get angry when Heisenberg asks whether one has the moral right to work on the application of atomic energy in wartime. As they play out that possibility, Bohr guides Heisenberg to do the calculation, which in turn leads Heisenberg to realize that creating an atomic bomb is within the realm of possibility. as Bohr says, quote, and suddenly a very different and very terrible new world begins to take shape. Frainlet's Margareta delivered the resolution to both the local and global instabilities in her comment to Bohr. That was the last and greatest demand that Heisenberg made on his friendship with you, to be understood when he couldn't understand himself. And that was the last and greatest act of friendship for Heisenberg that you performed in return, to leave him misunderstood. So, you know, Bohr had asked, why didn't you do the equation? They did it, something would have been very different. That's the suggestion. The denouement then accomplishes two important functions. The first rounds off the resolution by suggesting that Heisenberg repaid Bohr's final act of friendship. Bohr concludes that Heisenberg was responsible for ordering his man in Copenhagen to leak the news of the Nazis' imminent invasion in 1943 in time for Bohr to escape. With this rounding off, both the tensions and instabilities are resolved. Bohr, Margareta, and Heisenberg can now live in harmony and peace in this afterlife. The second function of the denouement is to emphasize the difference between the terrible world we have and an even more terrible world that we could have had if the evening in Copenhagen had turned out differently. It accomplishes this function by returning to individual moments where life and death hang in the balance. First, Heisenberg's meeting with the SS officer, and then a return to the moment when the Bohrs lost their son in a drowning accident. The final speech given to Heisenberg aptly sums up the situation. But in the meanwhile, in this most precious meanwhile, before the world is no more, there it is. The trees in Fallot Park, Gammertingen and Biberach and Mindelheim, our children and children's children, preserved by that one short moment in Copenhagen. In sum, on this account, the play brilliantly manages the tensions and instabilities so that it simultaneously takes the characters and the audiences along a path to a particularly moving conclusion. Okay, but now what happens when we remove uncertainty from the brackets in which I put it at the beginning of the talk? For one thing, it means I have to insert it back into Heisenberg's final speech. He actually says, preserved just possibly, which I left out in my previous quote, by that one short moment in Copenhagen. And he goes on to say, by some event that will never be located or defined, by that final core of uncertainty at the heart of things. And putting the uncertainty back into the final speech means underlining the way that the final speech echoes the thematic emphasis on uncertainty throughout the play. Nevertheless, the emotional force of the temporal progression strongly qualifies the meaning of Heisenberg's final lines. The forward movement of the play has worked not by exactly denying the final core of uncertainty at the heart of things, but by ignoring it. Bracketing uncertainty has shown that the temporal progression of the play depends on a different logic, one that assumes it's possible to reduce the uncertainties in our lives, and one that shows the power of our desire to reduce those uncertainties. But unbracketing uncertainty and giving it its due means recognizing that the thematics of uncertainty are also part of the progression, and that their presence does seriously qualify the play's resolution. Their presence means that Frayn's answer to the why done it does not come across as the answer, but rather as one possible answer that I hope you'll regard as plausible, or even as one highly ingenious hypothesis based on the ultimately unknowable psychodynamics of the Heisenberg-Bohr relationship. But even as I acknowledge the strong interaction between the temporal progression and the thematics of uncertainty, I want to underline the point that Frayn has been working with two incompatible logics in his construction of the play. The logic of the temporal progression and its drive toward a solution, and the logic of the thematic component and its insistence on uncertainty. Frayn's genius, I believe, is that he manages to reconcile these logics rather than have them split the play apart. The hidden coherence lies, I suggest, in Frayn's application of the scientific principle that allows for incompatible logics, Bohr's theory of complementarity. Just as light is a particle and light is a wave, Copenhagen asserts that there's a final core of uncertainty at the heart of things and that the world is knowable. More generally, if I'm right, Copenhagen demonstrates that complementarity applies not just in the realm of science, but also in the realm of narrative art, especially in the possible relations between temporal progression and theme. Thank you.